Chapter 3. Climate Change, the Catalyst for a New World Order. Climate change poses an existential threat to our lives, to our economy, and the threat is here. It's not going to get any better. President Joe Biden, September 7th, 2021. Times Square in New York City is truly one of the most remarkable locations on Earth. It is the very definition of sensory overload. It's a place that has the potential to captivate, amaze, and disgust visitors. And really, most times, all at the same time. If you ever want to eat one of the world's best hot dogs while watching a homeless guy fight a guy in a bear suit, Times Square really is a place to be. Anyone who has ever lived in the city knows that real New Yorkers don't actually go to Times Square. But I do admit that when I lived in New York, every now and then I would find myself wandering past its perpetually glowing streets, if for no other reason than to be reminded of how breathtaking and shocking the city can be. When I would make these little excursions, I was always struck by the continuous presence of doomsayers. No matter what's happening in New York, you are guaranteed to find at least one person, and usually many more, standing on a street corner in Times Square, shouting prognostications about the end of the world, often with a crudely written sign made of cardboard that declared, "The end is near." Every single day, hundreds of thousands of people pass through Times Square, and almost no one takes these claims seriously. And why would you? A dire warning scribbled on the back of an old pizza box is hardly the most persuasive mode of communication. But that's not the only reason New Yorkers take these predictions of doom and gloom with a grain of salt. Even if someone were to come along and build a very elaborate booth featuring the country's most articulate and intelligent persuaders, and even if these folks could convince some passerby that the world is really about to end, eventually no one would take them seriously, no matter how much proof they claim to have. Why? Because we wake up each morning and find that the world has, in fact, not ended. Sure, things change, but inevitably the sun rises in the east and it sets in the west and life goes on. The reason people, especially non-religious people, do not believe the world is on the verge of ending is because no matter how many times those predicting disaster say, "The end is near," the end isn't. It's not near. It never comes. Our very existence serves as proof against the claim. And the more these predictions are proven false, the less reliable the sources appear. So street corner doomsayers, they're going about fear-mongering all wrong. If you really want to fool people into thinking that all of humanity is staring down the barrel of a gun, you should ditch your cardboard sign and adopt the following four-step guide utilized by radical environmentalists over the past half century. Step one, establish a very flexible timeline. Do not tell people that the disaster you're predicting is so imminent that they will see whether or not you're right in the near term. But also, don't make your soon-to-be crisis so far into the future that no one walking around today will live to see its effects. Step two, propose potential solutions. You cannot predict a disaster that cannot be solved. There's no point in convincing people life on Earth's going to end if there's nothing you can do about it. Because even if you do convince everyone that they are indeed doomed, all they can do is hope that you're wrong. Three, create a consensus. Find real scientists who support some part of your claim, and then pretend that they support all of your claim. Do not worry about getting caught in a lie, because most people won't bother to even check the scientific literature to see if what you've been saying is even true. Also, if possible, track down dishonest scientists who will back your claim in exchange for funding. And finally, step four, constantly shift your prediction. Before it becomes apparent to everyone that your first prediction is wildly inaccurate, make a new prediction, then repeat steps one, two, and three. By following this proven four-step process, environmental groups with close ties to ruling class elites have managed to fool many people for decades, especially young Americans who have not had the benefit of seeing firsthand just how inaccurate so many predictions of environmental catastrophe have been, believe me, I lived through the 70s and 80s. But the closer that fair-minded people look at the constant fear-mongering of environmental elites, the more obvious it is that many of those claiming the science is settled on alleged environmental crisis like climate change are nothing more than highly sophisticated street-corner doomsayers. They may not be writing their messages on the back of an old pizza box, but their predictions are often just as inaccurate. In several of my previous books, I've spent a great deal of time showing that the so-called climate crisis we are always hearing about from the mainstream press is not nearly what it has been cracked up to be. You know, somewhere between post-apocalyptic Mad Max hellscape and the planet Tatooine in Star Wars. We have not, contrary to the claims of so many elitist environmentalists, experienced substantially more wildfires in recent years. According to the National Interagency Coordination Center, which is responsible for tracking wildfires in the United States, there were more wildfires during the 2005-2009 period than there were from 2010 to 2014. And there are more wildfires from 2010 to 2014 than from 2015 to 2019. We have not experienced any significant increase in the number or severity of hurricanes either. In a 2018 study of hurricane activity published in the Bulletin of American Meteorological Society, they found that despite some modest warming in the United States, there has been no significant trends in landfalling hurricanes, major hurricanes, or normalized damage consistent with what has been found in previous studies. Further, and perhaps most important, crop production has not been in decline. It has been dramatically increasing. The UN Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, the database shows worldwide production of cereals, wheat, coarse grain, and rice are all at or near record highs. In February 2020, the United Nations reported, quote, FAO's forecast for world cereal production in 2020 has been revised upward by 9.3 million tons this month and stands at almost 2,790 million tons, with the global output set to surpass record highs that were reached in 2019 by as much as 3%. 81.3 million tons. Global wheat production is pegged at 761.5 million tons, up 3.2 million tons from the previous month, and now at par with last year's above average outturn, end quote. Unfortunately, because of the great influence that elites have over the mainstream press, those facts from the UN are lost on most Americans and the public at large, which is routinely battered with dire and disturbing reports about famine, fires, and storms that are all allegedly linked to climate change, fueled by shoddy, ideologically motivated reporting and propaganda. Tens of millions of Americans now think climate change poses a grave danger to human civilization and all life on Earth. When Senator Elizabeth Warren, an ivory tower elitist if there ever was one, said that climate change is the existential threat, the one that threatens all life on this planet, millions of people believed her. When Joe Biden, a man who came to Washington 10 presidents ago, said climate change poses an existential threat to our future and we're running out of time to address it, millions believed him and then voted for him to be president. When well-read publications like the Washington Post, newspaper owned by Amazon's billionaire CEO Jeff Bezos, repeatedly frames climate change as an emergency and existential threat and says it is likely to cause an indescribable catastrophe, millions of people believe it. Now, this does not mean, of course, that the climate hasn't changed in recent decades and it won't change in the future or isn't changing now. Climate, by definition, is always changing. And there are some very highly respected, well-intentioned scientists who believe that climate change is being driven, in at least part, by human activity. And there are other well-qualified scientists and economists who believe that those changes to the climate are going to create economic problems and some environmental problems. There are many scientists who disagree with these claims, by the way, but we'll address that later in the chapter. But here's what virtually no reasonable scientist believes: that humanity is in grave danger because of climate change, or that the human race and all life on the planet, as Elizabeth Warren said, is facing the possibility of extinction. No one. The constant false drumbeat that because of global warming, human life could soon be wiped out, the meaning of existential threat, has deeply impacted an entire generation of young people worldwide, including in the United States. This has opened the door to radical changes to society and the global economy that supporters of the Great Reset are now calling for. Without the widespread fear of climate change and its impacts, shifting economic and social power into the hands of elites would be considerably more difficult under the Great Reset's framework. Generation Greta. Perhaps the single most surprising comment you'll ever read in this book, which is really saying something since it's a book about a massive conspiracy to reset the global economy, is that I actually kind of like Greta Thunberg. I mean, kind of. I mean, hear me out. In recent years, Greta, a teenager from Stockholm, Sweden, has become one of the world's most beloved and influential young climate activists. Thunberg became famous in 2018 after leading a massive student strike in front of the Swedish Parliament building, during which she and thousands of other young people demanded reforms that would reduce carbon dioxide emissions, which they believed to be the cause of deadly climate change. These climate strikes soon spread to other countries, and by late 2019, millions of students had walked out on school. Man, I wish I would have had that excuse when I was a kid. In September 2019, Greta became a household name after traveling to the United Nations headquarters in New York City to deliver a speech for the UN Climate Action Summit. During the speech, Thunberg skewered, to put it mildly, government leaders across the globe for not doing enough to avert climate catastrophe. "This is all wrong," Thunberg said. "I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you have all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing," she continued. "We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? You say you hear us and you understand the urgency, but no matter how sad and angry I am, I do not want to believe that. Because if you really understood the situation and you kept on failing to act, then you would be evil. And that I refuse to believe." Thunberg later accused international leaders of being guilty of betrayal of young people, warning them that we will never forgive you and that change is coming whether you like it or not. So here's the thing. You gotta hand it to her. I mean, she has serious spunk, right? I mean, I disagree with everything, and perhaps all the way down to her haircut. But I can't help but feel sympathetic while listening to her, you know, a little bit. Her rant on climate change and dysfunctional government bureaucrats and politicians. Try for a moment to put yourself in her, tiny clog shoes and think about her life. Her entire life, she's heard that the world is on the verge of total collapse. So you've been taught, you believe, the oceans will soon swallow up whole cities and possibly even some countries. You believe, as Thunberg said during her speech, that people are suffering and dying because of climate change right now. You think government officials have stolen the dreams of children all over the world. You believe that disasters of biblical proportions are on the horizon. Real wrath of God type stuff. Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies, rivers, seas boiling, 40 years of darkness, earthquake, volcanoes, dead rising from the graves, human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. I'm sorry, did I just trail off into a quote from Ghostbusters? I think I did. Anyway, the point is, if you were not sure that the human race is going to survive because you believe climate change is truly an existential threat. And then you look around and you see those in power who say they believe the same thing, doing much less than what many of them even say would be required to save the planet. Suddenly, every other public policy problem looks like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, right? And I'm sure this is the way Greta sees this. And she's one of the few voices of reason yelling, what the heck is wrong with you people? We just hit an iceberg, or we're about to. Yeah, yeah, kid, we get it. The crew responds, let's get back to work on the whole deck chair thing. So like I said, I like Greta, sort of. I mean, I appreciate that she is at least consistent with her message and passionate about an issue that she really believes is causing a worldwide crisis. Unlike so many people in government and media who spend their time talking about climate change, Greta's not interested in attaining power for herself. She would just like to positively impact the planet. Now, I don't share many of her beliefs or her proposed solutions for sure, but I do respect what I interpret as her real sincerity. Climate alarmist politicians, on the other hand, are anything but sincere, which is why you'll frequently catch them putting down their climate doomsday pizza box sign so they can spend more time talking about far less dire public policy problems like immigration reform, student loan debt, or adding more bike trails. Adding more bike? What? If you really believe the world is about to end, like Greta does, you would not waste 1 second or $1 worried about anything else. The inherent contradiction is enough to drive anyone mad, even Swedish teens, apparently. This is the bizarre world in which Greta Thunberg lives, and a lot of our children do, or grandchildren. She's not alone. A growing share of people believe that human civilization is on the brink of collapse because of climate change. An extensive 2019 survey of attitudes around the world about climate change found that 40% of Americans believe it is likely or very likely that climate change will cause a new world war. Further, 61% of Americans say it is likely or very likely that cities will be lost to rising sea levels, and 38% say it's likely or very likely climate change will cause the extinction of the human race, end quote. 38%. In many European and Asian countries, these figures actually are even higher. 45% of those surveyed in France, 43% of those surveyed in Spain, 70% of those polled in the Philippines say they believe climate change will cause the human race to go extinct. Extinct, as in all humans, the entire human race, will cease to exist forever. Evidence suggests those fears are having a powerful and disturbing impact on millions of people around the world, including many children. In March 2020, Reuters reported that a poll of 2,000 kids in Britain aged 8 to 16, conducted by Savanta Comres for BBC's Newsround, showed that, quote, 1 in 5 children are having nightmares about climate change, end quote. About 17% of children in Britain said worries about climate change were disturbing their sleep, while 19% said these fears were giving them nightmares, according to Reuters. In an article about climate grief published in 2019 by Kaiser Health News Service, Seattle area therapist Andrew Bryant said that a UN report on climate change issued in October 2018 had a profound impact on his patients. Quote, I remember being in sessions with folks the next day, Bryant said. They had never mentioned climate change before. And then they were like, I keep hearing about this report. Some of them expressed anxious feelings, and we kept talking about it over our next sessions. According to Kaiser Health News, Bryant further said that he has, quote, been seeing patients with anxiety or depression related to climate change and the Earth's future, end quote. He continued, Often these patients want to do something to reduce global warming, but are overwhelmed and depressed by the scope of the problem and difficulty in finding solutions, end quote. Kaiser Health News continued, they're anxious about how the earth will change over the rest of their or their children's lifetimes. This is a huge problem, okay? Climate grief has become such a big problem that numerous support groups helping students and even older adults learn how to cope with climate change have developed all across the country. In 2019, CBS News reported, as the planet continues to deal with the effects of climate change, where the American Psychological Association says more people are dealing with eco-anxiety, a chronic fear of environmental doom. Two women, Amy Lewis Rowe and Laura Schmidt, have created a 10-step program to help people cope with the psychological fallout associated with climate change. The name of the organization founded by Rowe and Schmidt is the Good Grief Network, GGN. On its website, the GGN asks questions such as, does species extinction or climate change keep you up at night? Do you see collapse on the horizon? Have you ever felt helpless or hopeless about racism, classism, sexism, homophobia, and other systematic issues? It promises to help people build a personal resilience while strengthening community ties to help combat despair, inaction, eco-anxiety, and other heavy emotions in the face of daunting, systematic predicaments. Quote, I saw that no government was taking it seriously enough. And that caused me an awful lot of eco-grief and climate anxiety, Schmidt explained to CBS News in an interview. Quote, and so what we did is we designed a program that can help other people move from that place of despair and disempowerment to building community, really feeling the weight of the world, but in a good way, in an empowering way that allows us to make change once we come together and see we're not the only ones feeling this deep despair, end quote. In March 2017, the American Psychological Association, Climate for Health, and Eco America issued a report outlining many of the psychological impacts of climate change. In the report, the authors noted, quote, watching the slow and seemingly irrevocable impacts of climate change unfold and worrying about the future for oneself, one's children, and later generations may be an additional source of stress. Qualitative research provides evidence that some people are deeply affected by feelings of loss, helplessness, and frustration due to their inability to feel like they're making a difference in stopping climate change. Some writers stress the possible detrimental impact of their own behavior on future generations, end quote. I find this so tragically sad. The issue has become so widespread among younger people that universities have now started issuing guidance to students struggling to deal with the perceived danger of climate change. In an article published by Boston University titled, Feeling Stressed About the Environment? You're Not Alone. BU environmental activists provide students with advice for dealing with climate catastrophes and climate grief, including, you have to be kind to yourself and kind to other people and understand that everyone has a lot on their plate already. So finding that balance between pushing yourself and being kind to yourself can be really hard to navigate. When I find myself going down rabbit holes like, should I even have kids? Is our planet going to exist that long? Running is a good grounding thing. Being outside has got to be the biggest thing I do to find inspiration and relieve anxiety. I find it's a good stress reliever and a powerful reminder of why all of this matters, end quote. As the Boston University article suggests, fears of a looming climate change disaster have become so completely out of control that many people are now questioning whether they should even bother bringing children into a warming world. AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a congresswoman and the face of the Green New Deal, made headlines in March 2019 when she admitted that extreme worries over climate change have affected her thinking about becoming a mother as well as thinking of other young people. Basically, quote, there's scientific consensus that the lives of children are going to be very, very difficult, Ocasio-Cortez said. And it does lead, I think, young people to have legitimate questions. Is it okay still to have children? End quote. Around the same time Ocasio-Cortez made her comments, Business Insider conducted a survey which found that nearly 38% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 agreed that climate change should be a factor in a couple's decision about whether or not to have children. And 34% of Americans between the ages of 30 and 44 agreed. Additionally, Business Insider reported, agreement was also linked to the belief that climate change is man-made. 38% of respondents who said the Earth is getting warmer, mostly because of human activity, such as burning fossil fuels, said couples should factor in the effect of that warming on their children before having them. Meanwhile, 33% disagreed, and another third were neutral or just didn't know. In 2018, a similar poll by the New York Times found that one-third of Americans said they decided to have fewer children than their ideal number because of fears related to the effects of climate change. So along with depression, anxiety, general malaise caused by the elite's constant scare tactics, climate hysteria has now spawned radical protests. And I'm not talking about the students taking the opportunity to leave school early protest either. I'm talking about the stopping trains, spraying blood on government building kind of protest, you know. The ones that protest, call me old-fashioned, we used to call riots. One of the leading groups dedicated to climate riots is called Extinction Rebellion, which labels itself as an international movement that uses nonviolent civil disobedience in an attempt to halt mass extinction and minimize the risk of societal collapse. These nonviolent acts of civil disobedience include, but are not limited to, using an old fire truck to spray fake blood on the Treasury building in central London, disrupting mass transit systems during rush hour, and gluing themselves to the doors of a bank. You can't make this stuff up. These protests may seem asinine as well as frustrating for Londoners trying to take the train home from work or bank employees forced to spend the morning scraping glue-covered lunatics off the front door. But try to imagine what you'd be willing to do if you truly believed the world was about to come to an end. Green is the new yellow journalism. It is easy for those of us who do not cry ourselves to sleep at night out of fear that the world is ending to dismiss climate grief and climate anxiety as totally insane. However, it is really important to have empathy and remember these intense feelings are logical if the underlying assumption behind them that the world is on the edge of climate annihilation is true. So the real question is not, why are so many people terrified? It's, why do they think those fears are justified? Well, for more than two decades, America's education establishment, both at the K through 12 and higher education levels, as well as Hollywood and the music industry, have been working to convince Americans all over the country that climate change is imperiling life on Earth. But no one has done more to brainwash the masses than the elitist news media. For years, biased reporters have run literally thousands of stories promoting climate change doomsday scenarios that fair-minded scientists on both the left and the right have rejected as extremely unlikely to occur, regardless of whether Earth's modest warming trend continues. In 2017, New York Magazine published a shocking and disgustingly alarmist propaganda piece called The Uninhabitable Earth. In the article, author David Wallace Wells told readers, quote, it is, I promise, worse than you think. If your anxiety about global warming is dominated by fears of sea level rise, you're barely scratching the surface of what terrors are possible, even within the lifetime of a teenager today. And yet the swelling seas and the cities that will drown have so dominated the picture of global warming and so overwhelmed our capacity for climate panic that they have occluded our perception of other threats, many much closer at hand. Rising oceans are bad, in fact very bad, but fleeing the coastline will not be enough. No matter how well informed you are, you are surely not alarmed enough. Over the past decades, our culture has gone apocalyptic with zombie movies and Mad Max dystopias, perhaps the collective result of displaced climate anxiety. And yet, when it comes to contemplating real-world warming dangers, we suffer from an incredible failure of imagination. Wow! And they call me a fearmonger. So I guess rampant hurricanes and wildfires and cities sinking into the sea like Atlantis are not enough. Wallace Wells goes on to provide one of the most shocking lists of climate alarmism you will ever find, broken down by the following categories. Heat deaths, the end of food, climate plagues, unbreathable air, perpetual war, permanent economic collapse, and poisoned oceans. Wow. Wow. Now, I will tell you, I am still trying to figure out how climate change can cause both the end of food and perpetual war. Maybe we eat the people we can. I don't know how that works. But, I mean, if everybody's starving to death, who's doing all the fighting? Of course, Wallace Wells is just one writer out of hundreds who regularly promote extreme climate alarmism. CNN reported in January 2019 that 250,000 deaths a year from climate change is a conservative estimate. And believe me, no conservative has ever made that estimate. They are citing a ridiculous study, and they predict that food shortages, which have become less common in our warming world, will cause more than 500,000 additional deaths of adults by 2050. The study also claims that climate change will push 100 million more people into extreme poverty by 2030. Another ludicrous claim in light of the fact that hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty in just the last few decades, despite higher than average global temperatures. In September 2019, a foreign affairs writer who I'm not even going to attempt to say his name, really. I mean, you want to know who it was? Buy the hard copy. Anyway, he posted an article titled Climate Change is Already Killing Us, in which he said the bubonic plague could once again become a major global catastrophe if global warming continues, and that anthrax, yes, anthrax, could spread farther as a result of stronger winds. Anthrax. He also wrote that global warming is making cholera more difficult to control, and that malaria and dengue fever could become even more widespread. He even said that this is just the beginning. Rising sea levels and increased ocean acidification will reduce fishing and aquaculture, aggravating malnutrition and food insecurity. Contamination of aquifers is going to exacerbate the water shortages. Droughts, which already kill and displace more than any other type of weather catastrophe, are predicted now to grow longer and more frequent. The World Bank estimates that by 2050, there could be 1 billion climate refugees from sub-Saharan, South Asian, and Latin America. Wow. November 2019, Wire published How the Climate Crisis is Killing Us in 9 alarming charts. In the article, author Matt Simon presents and comments on one misleading chart after another in an obvious attempt to scare people. Charts include a map titled Infernos Everywhere and a graph conveniently and calmly titled Here Come the Diseases. One of my all-time favorite examples of climate alarmism is perhaps the most terrifying. In 2019, USA Today published an article titled Climate Change Could Zap Clouds, Bake the Earth Even More. In the article, writer Doyle Rice reported, quote, Many of the world's clouds could just disappear if the carbon dioxide we keep pumping into our atmosphere soars to extreme levels, a new study suggests. Rice further wrote, quote, "The lack of those cooling clouds would then trigger a spike in global temperatures, potentially as much as 14 degrees, melting polar ice and leaving coastal cities deep underwater." Wow! The bubonic plague, thousands of cities and towns underwater, 1 billion climate refugees, and a cloudless, lifeless, baked earth. Holy cow, if you actually believe that, I mean really, truly believe that, that this is what your future looked like, then boy, why wouldn't you be screeching, "How dare you," to the global elites that refuse to put an end to this insanity? I know if I believed it, if I hadn't lived in the 70s where we were afraid of food extinction by 1980 and that we were all going to freeze to death because it was global cooling, maybe I buy into this time. Okay? The climate hysteria has been driven to new heights. Recent years, it's gone insane to the effects of a death spiral of common sense that works a little something like this. Elites and their well-funded allies in environmental groups, and in some cases academia, make increasingly absurd predictions about climate collapse. The news media then just dutifully reports it as though God had handed the predictions down from heaven on stone tablets. Although an ever larger group of people, especially children, have started to believe the predictions, most adults still reject them. So in an attempt to scare those skeptical Americans into believing the science on climate change, the doomsday predictions and rhetoric get more and more extreme. Oh, flooding cities. Oh, how about a baked earth? How about we die in a fiery flood? That'll do it. Because climate change has been portrayed as so imminent and potentially cataclysmic, alarmists say there's no time for debate. Science is settled. They've declared it. And anyone who disagrees is labeled as a climate denier, an obvious attempt to conjure up Holocaust denialism and push people out of the public square, which moves the entire national conversation further and further towards insanity. Eventually, the only people allowed to talk about climate change in major media platforms are the elites, who stand to benefit financially and or politically from the hysteria. Oh, and their friends. This is not theoretical. This is exactly the strategy elites in the media have been pursuing for many years. In 2014, hundreds of BBC staff and journalists attended BBC Trust seminars in which they were told to stop giving, quote, "climate skeptics airtime," end quote. A report by BBC Trust explains its stance. The Trust wishes to emphasize the importance of attempting to establish where the weight of scientific agreement may be found and make that clear to the audience. So now, if someone comes on the air to talk about, you know, the dire cloud apocalypse, no one will be invited to counter the claim. Because in the subjective opinion of the BBC's editors, that's where the weight of scientific agreement may be found. And how exactly does the BBC know what the weight of scientific agreement is? Are they themselves scientists? No, of course not. And they're not allowed to have any scientist on the air that don't agree with the dire claims, because they're deniers, remember? So there's no reason to believe what you see and read from the BBC and believe that it's truly reflective of the best available science. These sentiments have been expressed by many others in the media, not just the BBC. CNN made its views clear when it released a video in December 2018 telling viewers not to believe the climate change lies spread by prominent Republicans. Chuck Todd, the host of NBC's Meet the Press, opened his show on December 30th, 2018, with a monologue about how he is not going to give any airtime to climate deniers. Just remember this pattern as we go later in the book. So what is it that makes somebody a climate denier? Well, here's a short list of things that I put together that might get you labeled a denier. One, you point out facts and statistics that counter alarmist assertions about catastrophic climate change. And by the way, catastrophic, I mean humanity ending. Two, you don't think the world's going to be put on an unstoppable path towards human extinction in 10 years because of climate change. Denier. Three, you think wind and solar energy cannot reasonably power the entire world. Four, you're concerned about the immense environmental damage caused by wind and solar facilities. Five, you're worried that switching to more expensive energy sources will just raise prices and reduce economic activity and then actually hurt the poor. Not only are these decisions by the media to ignore opposing views on climate change prime examples of terrible journalism and overt bias, but they are also, quite ironically, completely opposed to the scientific method. Many of the most important scientific discoveries in human history, from those made by Galileo to world-changing theories advanced by Einstein, were so remarkable precisely because they defied the scientific consensus of the time. In real science, carefully cultivated evidence and the scientific method is what matters, not consensus. Even if consensus were the gold standard, which it isn't, there is no scientific consensus suggesting that climate change is an existential threat that could wipe out humanity. And anyone who tells you otherwise is, in a very real sense, a true science denier. Reasons for skepticism. There are many reasons to reject the hellish vision of the future that elites are always screaming about and to believe it's very unlikely to occur. But I do think I can convince you by focusing on only three. First, many of the dire global warming predictions about hurricanes, wildfires, and other disasters have been made over the past few decades, and they've already been proven demonstrably false. Second, there are thousands of scientists all over the world who believe that a climate change doomsday scenario is not going to happen, contrary to the slew of breathless media reports that consume radio, television, print, digital publications on a near daily basis. During the same week Greta Thunberg was publicly shaming the elites at the United Nations, 500 scientists and prominent professionals in climate science and related fields sent a letter to the head of the United Nations warning the world should not rely on many of the most popular climate models, calling them, quote, unfit for their purpose, end quote. In fact, let me give you the whole thing. They wrote, quote, therefore, it is cruel as well as imprudent to advocate the squandering of trillions of dollars on the basis of results from such immature models. Current climate policies pointlessly and grievously undermine the economic system, putting lives at risk in countries denied access to affordable, reliable electrical energy. We urge you to follow a climate policy based on sound science, realistic economics, and a genuine concern for those harmed by costly but unnecessary attempts at mitigation. The signees also provided a list of arguments they claimed are strongly supported by available science, including natural as well as anthropogenic factors causing warming. Next, warming is far slower than predicted. Climate policy relies on inadequate models. More CO2 is beneficial for nature, greening the earth. Global warming has not increased natural disasters. Ultimately, they declared there is no climate emergency and thus no cause for panic. Well, further organizations like the non-governmental International Panel on Climate Change have for more than a decade been compiling a mountain of research by scientists skeptical of climate alarmism. Here, too, are good reasons to reject the world is going to end in 10 years arguments. In 2019, the NIPCC released the fifth volume of its Climate Change Reconsidered series, which features thousands of pages of peer-reviewed scientific and economic data and an analysis showing that the world is not about to experience a climate-induced apocalypse. So much for the whole science is settled slogan thing, right? This is what the elites and businesses and government are always parading. A third reason fair-minded Americans should not buy the sky is falling views on global warming is that for half a century or longer, establishment environmentalists have been making the same kind of terrifying yet absolutely false predictions on other topics, including population growth, pollution, global cooling. Why? Of course, it's all to promote far-reaching public policies, many of which promise to provide huge amounts of funding to big businesses willing to play ball. In many cases, the experts whom the mainstream press trot out to convince the world that the planet will be an environmental nightmare by 2050 are the same people who told us the planet would be an environmental nightmare by 2010. One of the most famous and influential doomsayers of the past century was Stanford scientist Paul Ehrlich. In the 1960s, media ran wild when he and a whole host of other experts from leading U.S. academic institutions claimed humanity was on an unstoppable trajectory towards widespread famine, death, and misery. In the Los Angeles Times report, published in November 1967, that cited Ehrlich's work, reporter George Getz wrote, quote, "It's already too late for the world to avoid a long period of famine," end quote. Paul Ehrlich said that the time of famines is upon us and will be at its worst and most disastrous by 1975. He, Getz also reported, said the population of the United States is already too big and that birth control may have to be accomplished by making it involuntary and by putting sterilization agents into staple foods and drinking waters, and that the Roman Catholic Church should be pressured into going along with routine measures of population control. Wow, I am so glad that we didn't adopt Ehrlich's plan to, you know, stuff birth control pills in every Big Mac in America, because as it turns out, the whole time of famines thing never happened. In fact, the opposite occurred. Farmers and food manufacturers are feeding more people today than ever before, and there's still plenty of room for progress. In December 1972, George Kukla from the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and Robert Matthews, who was then chairman of the Department of Geological Sciences at Brown University, wrote a highly influential letter to President Richard Nixon, claiming that at a recent conference of 42 top American and European investigators examining climate change have determined that a global deterioration of climate by the order of magnitude larger than nay hitherto experienced by civilized mankind is a very real possibility and indeed maybe due very soon. Those who are listening to this, who believe the Earth is headed for a global warming existential crisis, you are probably tempted to think, yeah, I get it. So like the scientific consensus on climate change has been around for the last 50 years. Well, no, it actually turns out the warning issued by these top climate investigators in the 1970s was not of global warming. It was a global cooling crisis. Quote, "The cooling has natural cause and falls within the ranks of processes which produced the last ice age. Existing data still do not allow forecast of the precise timing of the predicted development, nor the assessment of man's interference with the natural trends," the letter continued. "It could not be excluded, however, that the cooling now underway in the Northern Hemisphere is the start of that expected shift. At the present rate of cooling, it seems fast enough to bring glacial temperatures in about a century, if continuing at the present pace." Okay, these climate scientists then went on to warn President Nixon of the practical consequences of global cooling, including substantially lowered food production, increased frequency and amplitude of extreme weather anomalies, such as those bringing floods, snowstorms, and killing frosts, end quote. The global ice age scare soon caught on, and for the next several years, it seemed to be all the media could talk about. In 1974, The Guardian reported, space satellites show new ice age coming fast. June 74, Time reported another ice age could soon be upon the world. And then they reviewed the bizarre and unpredictable weather patterns of the past several years and pointed out that a growing number of scientists are beginning to suspect that many seeming contradictory meteorological fluctuations are actually part of a global climate upheaval. That's what a Time reporter wrote, adding later that, quote, the atmosphere has been growing gradually cooler for the past three decades, and that trend shows no indication of reversing. Time then further reported, climatological Cassandras are becoming so increasingly apprehensive for the weather aberrations that they are studying may be the harbinger of another ice age. By the way, the really good thing, you know, that the new ice age, so many environmentalists were clamoring about in the 1970s, never developed. Because even though many elites today make it sound as though a warming planet is the worst thing that could ever happen to humanity, history has repeatedly shown that global cooling events are much, much worse. Researchers who authored a 2015 article published in the prestigious academic journal The Lancet found after examining more than 74 million deaths occurring in 384 locations worldwide from 1985 to 2012, that most of the temperature-related mortality burden was attributable to the contribution of cold. The effect of days of extreme temperature was substantially less than that attributable to milder but non-optimum weather. In other words, cold weather is much deadlier than warm or even hot weather. Of course, eventually fears about the global ice age gave way to the fears about global warming, which then conveniently was renamed climate change. I mean, surface temperature rise was slowing dramatically from 98 to 2012. We got some failed predictions here. Yeah. Wow. Global climate change. They got all the bases covered. The long tradition of failed predictions continued in the 80s, the 90s, and well into the present period. In 1989, famed climatologist Jim Hansen, now a professor at Columbia University, predicted that the West Side Highway in New York City would be underwater by 2019 because of rising sea levels caused by global warming. This is just one of the many false predictions made by Hansen over the years. 2008, Hansen also alleged the Earth had reached its climate change tipping point and that within a decade, the Arctic would be free of ice in the summer. Okay, well, some scientists say it could happen within the next 15 years. Others predict it will not happen until 2050, if at all. The Associated Press reported in 1989 that Noel Brown, a senior environmental official for the United Nations, predicted that entire nations would be wiped off the face of the earth by rising sea levels if global warming trend is not reversed by the year 2000. According to the report, Brown also claimed that governments only had a 10-year window of opportunity to fix the coming climate crisis. Wow, that sounds so familiar, doesn't it? I wonder if the experts at big corporations and the World Economic Forum pushing climate change solutions spend their free time just reading old newspaper articles from the 80s like I do. Quote, as the warming melts polar ice caps, ocean levels will rise up to about 3 feet, enough to cover the Maldives and other flat island nations, said the Associated Press. AP later added that the UN Environmental Program and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency predicted, quote, coastal regions will be inundated. One-sixth of Bangladesh could be flooded, displacing a fourth of 90 million people. A fifth of Egypt's arable land in the Nile Delta would be flooded, cutting off its food supply. In 2004, The Guardian published an article covering a report issued by the Pentagon that predicted by 2010, the U.S. and Europe will experience a third more days with peak temperatures above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. The Pentagon also reportedly predicted that climate would become an economic nuisance due to storms, droughts, and hot spells, which would create havoc for farmers. The Guardian also noted that the Pentagon report claimed that mega droughts would affect the world's major breadbaskets, including America's Midwest, where strong winds bring soil loss, and that Bangladesh would become nearly uninhabitable because of the rising sea level. None of these doom and gloom predictions, nor any of the thousands of other promises of existential crisis-level climate catastrophes I have seen over the past few decades, has come even close to occurring. But that hasn't stopped the ruling class elites and the environmentalists providing funding for the continued promise of more and more chaos. If the mainstream media were even remotely close to being truly unbiased as a source of information, they would at the very least point out the abysmal dumpster fire level track record of climate doomsday prognosticators when reporting on their latest and greatest horror show climate change predictions. But of course they don't. So tens of millions of Americans are fooled every year into believing that just because a newspaper columnist says a catastrophe is right around the corner, it means it must be true. Just a side note here. People call me a catastrophist. I call me a catastrophist. I warn you about things. But have I ever said to you, don't check this out. Don't listen to people. Don't ask. Don't do your own homework. I say the exact opposite. When people try to shut you down and tell you you're not smart enough or qualified enough to figure it out, run. The nuclear option. You should always be skeptical of politicians, business leaders, activists, and others who say that the only way to solve a societal problem supposedly being caused by one or more groups having too much power is to vest even more power and authority into the hands of other, supposedly better, wiser, or more knowledgeable groups, especially the government. This is true when considering not only environmental issues, but also every other topic of importance. British politician and historian John Dalberg Acton, today commonly referred to as Lord Acton, famously wrote, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." It's a great line, but the rarely quoted sentence that follows is arguably even better. Great men are almost always bad men, even when they exercise influence and not authority. Still more when you superadd the tendency of the certainty of corruption by authority. Wow, great men are almost always bad men. Now, that doesn't mean that only people who achieve greatness or success in life are bad people, but rather, it means that those who are able to succeed in attaining power and influence for themselves tend to be corrupted by it. So no matter how good their intentions were at first, pundits and politicians on both the left and the right continuously warn us to be wary of granting great power to any person or group. Yet that hesitancy to give power is incompatible with the goals of elite and globalist institutions, all of which, to varying degrees, seek to obtain substantial amounts of influence and or authority in the pursuit of some noble goal. Elites often say they care a great deal about limiting the dangers associated with the centralization of political and economic power, but that's really true only when it comes to their ideological and political rivals. They don't believe power corrupts everyone. They just believe certain kinds of power corrupt certain kinds of people. And we're not those kinds of people. This way of thinking has developed into a savior complex that is rampant within the ruling class on all sides, especially within organizations like the World Economic Forum, which nearly everyone believes, if we only had one more authority or control over society, the world would be a much better place. Over time, No matter how altruistic this movement starts, this way of thinking always, not sometimes, but always, corrupts the minds of those seeking power. They inevitably transform every cause into a movement to gain more authority for themselves and like-minded people in institutions. Most Americans don't think of environmentalism as having been bastardized in this way. Environmentalists care only about stopping the extinction of lesser prairie chicken and protected sage grouse hand from annihilation and saving panda bears, right? And I mean, panda bears are kind of cute and cuddly. And I mean, they would never be saved by power-hungry authoritarian monsters, right? But the truth is, elitist environmentalists have proven to be one of the best examples of how a well-intentioned cause can evolve into a corrupt movement for societal control. Perhaps the best evidence for this argument is American elites' near-total rejection of nuclear power, which, although expensive relative to existing conventional energy sources like natural gas, provides tremendous environmental benefits compared to the green energy sources the ruling class is always trying to impose on Americans, primarily wind and solar power. Nuclear energy is significantly more reliable, more cost-effective, and by far more environmentally friendly. Plus, it produces almost no carbon dioxide emissions, the very thing environmentalists are always touting as the most important issue when it comes to building energy infrastructure. Wind and solar panel sources are not nearly as reliable as nuclear power because they don't generate any energy when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. Believe me, I know from personal experience. I was an early adopter of solar. My ranch that I built in the Rocky Mountains is powered almost entirely by renewable energy. And every time it snows, which, in case you didn't know, is a lot in the Rocky Mountains, I have to drag my butt outside to shovel the snow off the panels so they can start generating energy again once the snowstorm passes. This intermittency problem might merely be a pain for a guy with a ranch in the mountains, but it's catastrophic for a nation the size of the United States. If that nation were to try to run mostly on these unreliable sources of energy, this is the reason why in 2019, despite billions of dollars worth of government subsidies rolled out over many years, wind and solar only accounted for 7.3 and 1.8% respectively of total U.S. utility scale electricity generation. Nuclear, which you couldn't get Mother Teresa to say nice things. Nuclear receives very little positive attention, but it produced nearly 20% of utility-scale electricity. Intermittency is such a huge problem for wind and solar that currently it is virtually impossible to run the electric grid on these two forms of energy. Quote, solar and wind require that natural gas plants, hydroelectric dams, batteries, or some other form of reliable power be ready at a moment's notice to start churning out electricity if the wind stops blowing or the sun isn't shining. That's Michael Schellenberger for Forbes in 2019. By the way, Schellenberger is a leading environmentalist. He actually believes, you know, what we were talking about earlier, not catastrophic, but he believes that global climate change is happening. He is an expert, not just on the environment and climate change, but on nuclear energy. He added in the article, unreliability requires solar and or wind heavy places like Germany, California, and Denmark to pay neighboring nations or states to take their solar and wind energy when they're producing too much of it. Wind turbines and solar panels also have a much shorter lifespan than nuclear facilities. The U.S. Office for Nuclear Energy noted in 2020 that even as the average age of American nuclear reactors approaches 40 years old, experts say there are no technical limits to these units churning out clean and reliable energy for an additional 40 years or longer. Utilities now have the confidence and data they need to apply for a second 20-year operating license with the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, solar panels and wind farms? Oh, that's a whole different kettle of fish here. They last 2 to 3 decades. It's been 10 years since I put solar panels on, and I've already had to replace them once. Anyway, the short useful lifetimes of wind turbines and solar panels are one of the least talked about but most important aspects of energy policy. That's from Isaac Orr, an expert on energy policy at the Center for the American Experiment. Quote, here today, scrap metal by 2050. That's the rough life of wind turbines and solar panels, which only have useful lifetimes of 20 to 30 years. Now, that's according to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and Energy Sage. The short lifespan of wind and solar facilities, coupled with their lack of reliability, make these energy sources much more expensive than nuclear power. Orr noted, quote, when the shorter operating lifespans for wind and solar are accounted for, the total cost of rebuilding wind turbines every 20 years brings the cost to $13.5 million per megawatt, and replacing solar on a 30-year timescale results in a total cost of $21 million per megawatt, compared to less than $7 million per megawatt for nuclear. Nuclear, or concluded, is clearly the superior value to consumers. Wind and solar are so much more expensive that if Americans were just to get 80% of its electricity from wind, solar, and battery storage, the United States electricity bill would skyrocket by more than $1 trillion per year. That's trillion with a T. Also, despite the media-contrived depictions to the contrary, nuclear is a lot better for the planet than wind or solar, which is especially important considering that the whole reason Americans are being urged to commit economic suicide with plans like the Green New Deal and Biden's Green New Deal Light plan, which would impose wind and solar energy on most of the country over just a couple of decades, is that wind and solar facilities are so much greener than other forms of energy production. But nuclear facilities are safer, and they emit 4 times less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than do solar farms and wind farms. They require 400 times more land than nuclear power plants do as well. A 2019 Heartland Institute policy study noted the tremendous amounts of environmental harm that would be caused by replacing conventional energy sources with wind and solar. Not only would millions of bats and birds, including endangered species, be wiped out by the wind and solar facilities, but millions of other animal habitats across the country would need to be destroyed to make way for millions of new wind turbines and billions of new solar panels. According to Heartland's report, which was based in part on research conducted by environmental groups, the Fowler Ridge Wind Farm in Indiana covers 68 square miles. That's an area larger than Washington, D.C. If similar facilities were used to replace all of the country's fossil fuels and nuclear power, it would require 2.12 million turbines on 500,682 square miles of farm, wildlife habitat, and scenic lands. This would require an amount of land as large as the combined total for Arizona, California, Nevada, Oregon, and much of West Virginia. Heartland further estimated, if we use the cutting-edge Nellis Air Force Base solar farm as a model of the power such facilities can produce, we find that to generate the more than 8 billion megawatt hours each year, the energy needed to power the country with solar would require completely blanketing 57,000 square miles of land. So you know that's the equivalent size of the states of New York and Vermont, with 18.8 billion solar panels. I don't think this is going to work. I mean, I wonder how many endangered eagles would be obliterated by all of those new wind turbines. How many sage grouse, hens, and lesser prairie chickens would be forced from their habitats in order for us to build billions, literally billions of solar panels? By the way, I don't know about you, but I have a real hankering for some Chick-fil-A. Do they have grouse? Bulldozing millions of acres of land and killing millions of animals hardly sounds like green energy to me, but building poor-performing monstrosities is just the beginning. After a few decades, when all of the gigantic turbines and solar panels have to be torn down, where are you going to put them? I hate to break this to everyone who still thinks relying on wind and solar is a good idea, but you cannot just throw away decommissioned wind and solar parts into a big blue recycling bin and leave them out in the street for your local garbage man to pick up. Wind turbines and solar panels create huge amounts of waste, much of it toxic, and no one yet has developed a clean, cost-effective way to deal with that gigantic problem. And remember, this is an issue that would come up every 20 or 30 years as these facilities wear out. The International Renewable Energy Agency, IRENA, in 2016, estimated there was about 250,000 metric tons of solar panel waste in the world at the end of that year. IRENA projected that this amount could reach 78 million metric tons by 2050. Michael Schellenberger, in an article again for Forbes in 2018, quote, solar panels often contain lead, cadmium, and other toxic chemicals that cannot be removed without breaking apart the entire panel. Schellenberger, writing later, said, researchers with the Electric Power Research Institute undertook a study for U.S. solar-owning utilities to plan for end-of-life and concluded that solar panel disposal in regular landfills is not recommended in case modules break and toxic materials leach into the soil. So disposal is potentially a major issue, end quote. Additionally, wind turbines, which are ineffective in many parts of the country, are not good options either for the environment. In 2019, NPR reported the U.S. will have more than 720,000 tons of wind turbine blade material to dispose of over the next 20 years, a figure that does not include newer, higher, taller capacity versions. So it seems pretty clear. I mean, I'd go beyond a shadow of a doubt here that wind and solar are not nearly as environmentally beneficial as so many seem to think they are. They are environmentally toxic. But what about that big radioactive elephant in the room? Nuclear waste. And what about nuclear disasters like Chernobyl? Didn't that one event kill millions of people and thus justify never building another nuclear power plant again? No. The biggest roadblock for nuclear power is unquestionably misinformation about it that has been spreading for decades. When most people think of nuclear energy in America, they imagine glowing green sludge or something that's just popped into the back of Homer Simpson's coat. Three-eyed fish, huge radioactive catastrophes. These images don't resemble anything, none of the realities of nuclear power. Quote, it is reasonable to ask whether nuclear power is safe and what happens with the waste, end quote. This is what Schellenberger wrote in 2019. It turns out that scientists have studied the health and safety of different energy sources since the 1960s. Every major study, including a recent one by the British medical journal Lancet, finds the same thing. Nuclear is the safest way to make reliable electricity. End quote. The truth is, as Schellenberger notes, nuclear waste is not nearly the problem so many people claim it is. Homer Simpson isn't actually burying glowing green sludge under the parks for his villainous billionaire boss Monty Burns. Instead, nuclear waste consists of used nuclear fuel in the shape of rods about 12 feet long that eventually end up in a 15-foot-tall canister known as a dry cask, that weigh 100 tons or more. And although many imagine nuclear waste requires huge amounts of land to store, Schellenberger notes, if all the nuclear waste from the U.S. power plants were put onto a football field, it would stack up just 50 feet high. In comparison to the waste produced by every other kind of electricity production, that quantity is close to zero, end quote. It is also not true that millions of people have died from nuclear disasters like Chernobyl, which occurred more than 3 decades ago in 1986. Okay, how about 2011 Fukushima, that crisis in Japan, when an earthquake and subsequent tsunami hit the nuclear power plant? Although the Chernobyl event was the worst nuclear disaster in history, the World Health Organization estimates show that only 9,000 people had died or will die as a result of it, including cancer-related deaths. Only 31 individuals have died as a direct result of the incident. Further, as of 2018, only one person has died from radiation exposure coming from the Fukushima site. And there's an additional 573 that died from the stress of related evacuations. So, for context, about 25 times more people, 15,893, died in the tsunami that caused the nuclear disaster in the first place. Obviously, any loss of life is tragic, but these extremely rare instances hardly serve as proof that nuclear energy is comparatively dangerous. History has shown us the exact opposite is true. Nearly every other form of electricity generation is associated with causing more premature deaths than does nuclear. And currently, there are nations that have been safely relying on nuclear energy for decades. In 2018, 71% of the electricity produced in France, 55% in Slovakia, 53% in Ukraine, 50.6% in Hungary, 40% in Sweden, comes from nuclear power plants. Further, nuclear facilities generated more than one quarter of the electricity in Armenia, Finland, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Slovenia, Switzerland, and Belgium. No offense to the people of Slovakia and Hungary. But does anyone really truly believe these countries are better equipped to safely manage nuclear energy than the United States, the most powerful, scientifically advanced, and wealthiest nation on the planet? Of course not. Nuclear energy also offers a greater potential for technological breakthroughs and innovation. Advocates of wind and solar energy often tout recent increases in efficiency and claim that more improvements are just around the corner. However, the rate of these increases has decelerated. A 2019 report from the Manhattan Institute analyzed the cost of reductions and energy output of wind and solar energy just over the last few decades. The Manhattan Institute researchers found that the wind and solar energy improvements are slowing substantially. The report concludes the era of tenfold gains is over. But with nuclear power, there's still lots of room for improvement. Due to public fears and miles of regulatory red tape, the advancement of nuclear technology has been relatively stagnant for 50 years. But there are now in the works a number of new developments that could revolutionize the future of energy. Rolls-Royce is now attempting to develop small modular reactors, their SMRs. These mini reactors would require a fraction of the land needed for other forms of renewable energy and would generate a consistent flow of baseload energy. It would dramatically reduce the costs associated with nuclear power and could easily be scaled to meet specific energy needs. SMRs are the next evolutionary step of nuclear power, compact, affordable, quick to construct, emissionless, and even transportable. End quote. That, by the way, is according to Ariel Cohen, a program director and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He wrote that in a 2020 article for Forbes. Advancements in nuclear fusion are also underway. In 2020, assembly on the largest fusion program, the ITER project, began in southern France. The ITER, I-T-E-R project, has the potential of providing essentially unlimited clean energy by replicating the reactions that power stars like our sun. Several nations, including the United States, are contributing to this potentially game-changing project. So, if nuclear power is safer, it's more likely to experience revolutionary technological improvements, it's much more cost-effective, it's reliable, and so much more environmentally friendly than wind and solar, why are so many people in financial institutions and international corporations and government, including President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, want to spend trillions of dollars building millions of wind turbines and literally billions of solar panels instead of a few nuclear power plants? A big green grab for power. It's hard to imagine a more ideal justification for a long-term takeover of the global economy than the claim that climate change poses an existential threat to humanity. And in the face of certain doom, it's easy to argue the only way to solve this crisis is the vast gargantuan amounts of power in the hands of the ruling class. That way, they can save us all by managing the economy away from climate catastrophe. That's always just 10 years down the road. It's nice and tidy. Nuclear power might reduce carbon dioxide emissions, which people like Biden say they care about. But it does nothing to help the elites gain control over society. So naturally, most of them don't want anything to do with it. The very existence of the Great Reset movement proves how important climate change has become to global elites. Sure, the far-reaching deadly pandemics are useful. And yes, the coronavirus has created that golden opportunity men have been waiting for to justify a reset of capitalism. But in the end, nothing can match the opportunity presented by the claim that there is a looming, nearly unstoppable threat to all life on the Earth posed by global warming. An argument the Great Reset supporters have made repeatedly since the movement began. Geeta Gopinath, the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund and staunch supporter of the Great Reset, said at a June 2020 World Economic Forum meeting that shifting economies to green priorities should be a part of every nation's economic strategy under the reset. But how do we get to a more planet-friendly way of doing economic activity? What's needed is to ramp up production of alternative forms of energy, and secondly, to have infrastructure that's much more climate-friendly. In both of these measures, the public sector can play a very big role. Once you have those in place, alternatives to energy, greener physical infrastructure, then you can also obviously put on top of that carbon pricing, too. So companies and firms internalize the impact of their activities on the climate. Alluding to climate change, Sharon Burrow, the General Secretary of the International Trade Union Confederation, told the World Economic Forum, quote, "We want to end the profit at all costs mentality, because if we don't build an economic future within a sustainable framework in which we are respectful of our planetary boundaries and the need to change our energy and technology systems, then we'll not have a living planet for human beings," end quote. Jennifer Morgan, executive director of Greenpeace International, said the Great Reset needs to, quote, "put the health of people and the planet first," end quote. Morgan later added, "That's what's happening on COVID-19, but it's not happened yet on climate change in many cases, because fossil fuel interests and the large industrial farming interests want to keep things the way they are. And what we're learning from this pandemic is it is possible to switch it." Also, at the June World Economic Forum meeting, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, "We must build equal, inclusive, sustainable societies that are more resilient in the face of pandemics and climate change. April 2020, James Shaw, the climate minister for New Zealand and another supporter of the Great Reset, wrote in an article for The Guardian that the COVID pandemic, quote, is a time for governments, regions, cities around the world to mobilize and deploy resources to tackle the climate crisis at the same time as rebuilding their economies, all whilst creating high-value green jobs, end quote. Shaw said readers must imagine a future, quoting, that is more equitable, more prosperous, more innovative, and all within planetary limits, adding later that governments must now make bold decisions for the collective good. Prince Charles, one of the leading voices behind the Great Reset, said at the June 2020 WEF event, "The threat of climate change has been more gradual, but it is devastating reality for many people and their livelihoods around the world, and its ever greater potential to disrupt surpass even that of COVID-19. If we look at the planet as if it were a patient," Prince Charles added, "we can see that our activities have been damaging her immune system, and she's been struggling to function and thrive due to the strain we have put on her vital organs." Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum, has identified climate change as the next global disaster. Said if the world doesn't soon adopt the Great Reset, global warming will have even a more dramatic consequence on humankind than COVID-19. Quote, "We have to decarbonize the economy in the short window still remaining and bring our thinking and behavior once more into harmony with nature." Jawohl, Klaus. Nothing really says harmony with nature quite like strip mining the world for the rare earth minerals needed to construct billions of solar panels and storage batteries, grinding up millions of acres to build, you know, green energy facilities, and mass murdering millions of birds and other wildlife, destroying their habitat with giant wind turbines. Am I right, Klaus? Yeah? Justifying the machine. January 2019. Greta Thunberg spoke at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Her message was terrifying and revealing. "I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day, and then I want you to act." So notice that her message is not focused on determining the best path forward based on logic and reason. It's focused simply on taking action based on emotion and fear. That's the worst thing humans can do. This fear infects virtually every aspect of the modern climate change narrative and is frequently used to justify extreme actions, including those that would destroy the global economy and require massive government takeovers. And do I need to mention the land that is stripped as well? When Thunberg demanded that government leaders tear down the global economy at the United Nations late 2019, she had no idea that lurking right around the corner was a pandemic that would, within just a few months, radically alter the world's political, economic, and societal landscape. COVID-19 made what had previously seemed possible only to wildly idealistic teenagers like Thunberg into a policy platform for many of the planet's most powerful and influential figures. It is easy for relatively wealthy Swedish teens to demand hundreds of thousands of people around the world lose their jobs. It's no big deal for them to call for economies to collapse in the name of stopping climate change. But it is not as simple for people who have to play the role of economic executioner. Even for those who have long hoped for the same sorts of changes Thunberg demanded. What so many elites around the world initially did not have the stomach to do, the pandemic did it for them. By providing the ruling class with a reason that voters could tolerate for killing the global economy, the possibility of millions of people dying at the hands of a novel virus, COVID-19 offered leaders in business, government, and activism a golden opportunity to change, well, everything. And as a side benefit, potentially make trillions of dollars while doing it. More on that in chapter 5. Look, the whole time I've been reading this out loud to you, and I have had an attitude, and I've wondered whether or not that was the right kind of inflection to read this, because it's so snarky. But I want you to know, I deeply care about the environment. I deeply care about the importance of protecting the planet, its natural resources. My ranch sits in the Rocky Mountains, and we have acreage. I am a zealot on the land and the land around it. I want to make sure that it is preserved forever, so my kids and my grandkids and my great-great-grandkids and people who I don't even know for generations will be able to see the beauty of that land. And there's a lot of land in the world that we should all be able to pass on. So I care deeply about this. I believe humanity has a sacred responsibility to be good stewards of the earth. God provided not just us, to everything alive here. And unlike many Hollywood elites who like to tweet about how much they care about the planet between sips of champagne on a private jet traveling halfway around the world, I have put my money and my snow shovel and everything else where my mouth is. I have spent literally, I know this doesn't work, because I have had to spend a small fortune trying to power my home using renewable energy sources. And I got news for you. You don't live the life you're currently living, and you have blackouts or brownouts. You got to get used to them, because that's what happens. I truly do want to help protect the planet. But the truth is, as much as I would love for wind and solar panel to be the answer to the world's energy problems, the evidence is overwhelming. It isn't. Yet the ruling class continues to insist we all have to use it. Why? As history has repeatedly shown, sometimes there's just too much power to be seized and too much money to be made to worry about what's really in the best interest of Main Street America.